You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and thank you for joining The American Revolution. Today, episode 169, Articles of Confederation. We last checked in with the Continental Congress in episode 141, as the delegates held a session in Philadelphia. They had just returned to Philadelphia from Baltimore in March 1777, having fled the prior December, when they feared the British might invade Philadelphia from New Jersey. When that fear passed, they returned to Philadelphia. Then, in September of 1777, the British Army once again threatened Philadelphia, this time marching up from Maryland. The delegates fled the city as the Continental Army, under George Washington, attempted in vain to halt the British advance. The delegates had adjourned in Philadelphia on September 18th with plans to meet in Lancaster. They could not simply move straight from Philadelphia to Lancaster, as they would be passing over the same ground where the two armies under Washington and Howe were doing battle. Instead, the members took a circuitous route, first traveling up to Trenton, New Jersey, then over to Easton, Pennsylvania. From there, they moved west to Bethlehem, and they remained in Bethlehem for a few days, where many soldiers from the Battle of Brandywine and other area battles were still recovering. There were also Hessian prisoners of war there, who needed to be moved south to prevent the enemy from liberating them. After a few days, the delegates made their way west to Lancaster. On September 27th, the day after the British Army marched into Philadelphia, the delegates met at the Lancaster Courthouse to open a new session. They read a few letters from various generals, including one from the 15th from General Horatio Gates at Bemis Heights, getting ready for the big showdown with Burgoyne's army. When he wrote the letter, Gates had not yet fought the Battle of Freeman's Farm, but was optimistic about the army's chances of victory. Congress read another letter from General Washington from the 23rd. At the time he wrote it, General Washington still hoped to prevent the British army from entering Philadelphia and was begging for more supplies. Lancaster was about 60 miles from Philadelphia, probably at least 2 days' march for the British army. However, the delegates decided it was not quite far enough. After tending to a little more business in that one-day session, Congress adjourned. It ended the session in Lancaster with a resolution to meet 3 days later in the town of York, Pennsylvania. The new location would be 20 miles further from Philadelphia. It would also be across the Susquehanna River, placing another natural barrier between Congress and the British Army in Philadelphia. Another reason for the move was that the Pennsylvania legislature was also meeting in Lancaster. The combination of the two legislative bodies was probably more than the small town could handle. Thus, Lancaster had its one day as the nation's capital. York would become the seat of Congress for 9 months. On the first day in York, President Hancock received more correspondence from General Gates with further updates. He forwarded them to General Washington, since Gates was not keeping the commander up to date directly. Hancock added his own note, saying that he hoped to receive word from Washington soon that he had totally reduced General Howe's army. Washington, of course, made that attempt on October 4th when he attacked at Germantown. See episode 163. Despite his failure at Germantown, Congress nevertheless congratulated Washington on the attempt and ordered a medal struck in his honor. Despite the congratulations, delegates were not optimistic. John Adams wrote in his diary, indicating his desire for a new military leader who could lead America to victory. Quote, "Heaven grant us one great soul, one leading mind would extricate the best cause from the ruin that seems to await it. We have as good a cause as ever was fought for. One active, masterly capacity would bring order out of this confusion and save our country." Around this same time, Samuel Adams made a speech to the delegates where he said, "Our affairs are said to be desperate, but we are not without hope and not without courage. The eyes of the people of this country are upon us here, and the tone of their feeling is regulated by ours. If we as delegates in Congress give up in despair and grow desperate, public confidence will be destroyed and American liberty will be no more." Having just been chased out of Philadelphia, the delegates really seemed to be feeling on the ropes and desperate that the end might be near. Samuel Adams ended his speech by seeking hope from God to save the cause. Quote, "There have been great times since the opening of this war when we were reduced almost to distress. But the great arm of omnipotence has raised us up. Let us still rely for assistance upon him who is mighty to save. We shall not be abandoned by the powers above so long as we act worthy of aid and protection. The darkest hour is just before the dawn. Good news may soon reach us from the army and from across the sea." About this time, many members of Congress either took temporary leave or permanently left Congress to attend to other business. Among them was the President of Congress, John Hancock. He stepped down in October and wanted to return to Boston to attend to his business. He gave a simple farewell speech, and one of the delegates moved to thank Hancock for his nearly 2.5 years of service. You'd think a motion just saying thank you to a retiring officer would be pretty non-controversial, but it wasn't. Members objected, and the motion barely passed by a vote of 6 states to 4. Among those opposed was Hancock's own Massachusetts. Opponents argued that it was improper to thank any delegate simply for discharging his duties of office. Many of the delegates had grown to dislike Hancock, not the least of whom were Samuel and John Adams, who had worked with Hancock for decades. They considered Hancock vain and disliked his efforts to help friends secure political office. When a delegate asked Samuel Adams if he could forgive Hancock, he said he would both forgive him and forget him. For the new president, Congress chose Henry Lawrence of South Carolina. Lawrence came from a wealthy family of rice farmers, but had made a fortune as a partner in one of the largest slave trading companies in North America. He had served as a lieutenant colonel in the militia during the French and Indian War, where he led several campaigns against the Cherokee in the Carolinas. In the years leading up to the Revolution, Lawrence served in the Colonial Assembly, where he was considered a moderate in the political arguments with Parliament, and led efforts to broker a political compromise. However, as politics and South Carolina turned more radical, so did Lawrence. He served in the Provincial Congress in 1775 and became the state's first vice president in 1776. He had come to the Continental Congress as a delegate only a few months prior to his election as the body's new presiding officer. Henry Lawrence's son, John Lawrence, had been studying law in London before the war. He returned to America over his father's objections and took a commission in the Continental Army. To keep him out of direct combat, Henry got his son a position as an aide to General George Washington. This direct connection between Washington's inner circle and the President of Congress would prove crucial in the coming months. Just before Hancock resigned, Congress received unofficial word of a victory by Horatio Gates over General Burgoyne in New York. For several weeks, though, these were just rumors. Gates had won the Battle of Bemis Heights on October 7th, and then accepted Burgoyne's formal surrender on October 17th. Both General Washington and General Putnam forwarded to Congress news of the victory, which arrived there on October 21st. However, neither Washington nor Putnam had received official word or direct word from Horatio Gates or anyone with the army. Instead, they heard the news from New York Governor George Clinton. General Gates sent word to Congress via his messenger, Colonel James Wilkinson. Traditionally, a commander would send a messenger of a great victory with the expectation that Congress would award that messenger with a promotion. In this case, Colonel Wilkinson was hoping to become General Wilkinson. The would-be general, however, did not seem in any hurry to get to Congress. He left Albany on October 20th. He made his way to Easton, Pennsylvania, 4 days later, where he dined with local officials. He managed to get to Reading by the 27th, where he dined with Lord Stirling, who was still recovering from wounds received at Brandywine. Also present at that dinner was a young major, James Monroe, who was still recovering from his wounds at the Battle of Trenton. At the dinner, Wilkinson drank a little too much and began discussing the possibilities of replacing Washington with Gates as commander of the Continental Army. Moving on, it took Wilkinson another 4 days to make the 50-mile trip to York, where he finally arrived on October 31st. Although he had stopped to meet with a number of other officers, he did not bother to stop and provide General Washington with the news, nor did Gates make any effort to transmit the information to his commander at any time. Washington finally received definitive notice from Congress, not from Gates. While Congress was happy to receive confirmation of the great victory, they were not happy with how long it took Wilkinson to arrive. By the time of his arrival, Hancock had resigned, but Lawrence had not yet been elected. Wilkinson gave his message to Secretary Charles Thompson, who was presiding in the interim. A few days later, after Lawrence's election, Congress voted to give Wilkinson a ceremonial sword. Several delegates remarked that perhaps ceremonial spurs or perhaps a whip might have been better to assist the young man in traveling a little faster. Congress also voted to give Wilkinson a brevet promotion to Brigadier General. Congress also was not happy with the terms of surrender that Gates had given Burgoyne's army. The decision to allow the British and Germans to return to England seemed to undercut the value of capturing the army in the first place. Whatever their concerns, publicly, Congress voted on November 4th to thank General Gates for his great victory. It also voted to set December 19th as a national day of thanksgiving to God for allowing such a great victory. Much of Congress's daily work involved correspondence. Congress regularly received letters from all sorts of people. Many came from generals, state politicians, or other notable men. Typically, such letters would be read aloud and acted on by the entire body or sent to a committee for further consideration. In mid-October, General Washington forwarded a letter from the Reverend Jacob Duché in Philadelphia. Duché had served as minister to the First Continental Congress and was considered a patriot. He had remained in Philadelphia when the British Army occupied the city, and there he was arrested on charges of treason against the king. The British soldiers released Duché a short time later, but Duché sent a letter to General Washington essentially saying that he never really supported independence and that the rebellion was pretty much lost at this point. He called on Washington to renounce independence, seek a negotiated peace, accept pardons from General Howe, and return royal authority to America. Washington often forwarded letters to Congress without comment if he thought it involved something that Congress needed to make a decision about. In this case, however, he forwarded the letters with comments that he thought the author's comments were curious, extraordinary, and ridiculous. Even so, it was Congress's place to respond to any political proposal, not the place of a military commander. Congress read the letter but did not act on it. the letter eventually reached state officials who charged Duché with treason against the state of Pennsylvania and confiscated all of his lands. Duché would be forced to leave Philadelphia with the British and would be exiled from his home state. Such defeatism would not be tolerated. Also, within a few days of opening the York session, even with all the other things happening, the Congress resumed its debate on the Articles of Confederation. Since just after passage of the Declaration of Independence, more than a year earlier, Congress had been debating the Articles 2 or 3 days each week. After getting to York, the delegates made a final push, spending at least some time every day to finalize the agreement on the Articles. Debate remained contentious. One of the biggest issues was over representation. Should each state be represented equally? Should it be based on population? Or should it be based on the wealth of each state and how much money each contributed to Congress? Other contentious issues over the next few weeks included the power to tax, the authority to settle state boundaries, and the length of terms for delegates. Finally, on November 15th, Congress agreed to the final wording of the Articles of Confederation. They sent the documents to the printers so that they could send them to the states for ratification. The articles were the product, as I said, of considerable debate and disagreement. The delegates, however, reached a compromise in the interest of having some sort of governing document. The loss of Philadelphia seemed to focus their debate. Some were doubting whether Congress could remain a body at all. Many of its most prominent delegates had left for positions within their states or abroad. Without some agreed document establishing Congress's legitimacy, it could possibly just fade away. The final document recognized the independence and sovereignty of each individual state. It recognized that each state retained all of its general sovereign authority, except for a few explicitly defined powers that were granted to Congress. Many of the provisions simply defined the mechanics of how Congress would operate, or was really already operating. Delegates would be selected by states for one-year terms, beginning each November. Delegations could be between 2 and 7 members, whatever the state wanted, and within those limits could change the number of delegates at any time. States also had the authority to recall a delegate at any time. Regardless of how many delegates each state sent, each state got one vote in Congress. Delegates would hold their own votes to decide how the state would vote on any given issue. Each Congress would select a president for a one-year term. No president could hold that office for more than 1 out of every 3 years. States would work together for mutual defense. Congress retained for itself the power to declare war or peace. No state could go to war against another country unless it was actually invaded. During war, states would commission officers below the rank of colonel. Congress would commission colonels and generals. States could not keep their own navies in time of peace unless authorized by Congress. Congress would retain sole authority to run prize courts for ships or other property captured by privateers. Costs of prosecuting the war would be incurred by Congress, who would then collect shares of the costs from each state based on the total value of property in that state. State governments would be responsible for actually collecting the taxes however they like and then sending the money to Congress. The documents further stated that Congress held the authority to maintain diplomatic relations with other countries. States could not send their own ambassadors or open embassies in other countries. Congress retained the exclusive right to enter into treaties, including commercial treaties, with other countries. States could not form treaties with each other. All relations between states would be through Congress. States would not impose taxes on foreigners that differed from those of their own citizens, nor could they create import and export restrictions on goods. States also agreed to give full faith and credit to each other's laws and court decisions. If a criminal fled from one state to another, a state would have to return the fugitive for trial or punishment in the state that retained jurisdiction for the crime. Free citizens would have all the privileges and immunities of citizenship in each state, and had the right to travel freely between states, except, of course, for slaves, paupers, vagabonds, and fugitives. Congress retained the power to set standards for coins and currency, and it would be the final arbiter of any state boundary disputes. Any decisions by Congress to enter a treaty, borrow money, authorize expenditures, increase the size of the military, engage in an act of war, or even appoint a commander of the Army or Navy would require a vote of at least 9 states. In other words, it would require a 2/3 majority if all 13 states voted. The articles authorized Canada to join the Union if desired. Any other state wishing to join the Union would require the approval of at least 9 states. Approval of the articles would require ratification by all 13 states before it could go into effect. Any future amendments to the articles would also require unanimous approval by all states, as well as the approval of Congress itself. Congress submitted the articles to the states for ratification. Just as debate had been contentious within Congress, so it was in the state legislatures. One of the biggest sticking points for many state leaders was the authority given to Congress to set state boundaries. Many states had claims on land stretching all the way to the Pacific Ocean. Some also had boundary disputes with neighboring states. State leaders had great concerns about letting Congress make decisions about how to resolve those disputes. Congress would likely make new western states out of most of their land and would use land sales to pay off promises to veterans or raise other funds. The value of those western lands were seen as future income for many states. They did not simply want to give that wealth away. At the same time, many states without western land claims absolutely wanted those lands turned over to Congress. They did not want to be next to huge states that dominated the continent and dwarfed their own limited land claims. These states would not ratify the articles until the larger states showed a willingness to give up their claims to western lands. It had taken Congress well over a year to work out the proposed Articles of Confederation. The states would debate ratification for another nearly 4 years. The last holdout, Maryland, would ratify the articles in 1781, finally allowing them to take effect. Until then, Congress would continue to operate under its own ad hoc rules, making up the rules as they went along and simply hoping that the states would comply. Meanwhile, Congress continued to publish the articles, even producing a French version to send to Benjamin Franklin in Paris. Delegates hoped that it would convince the French to recognize the United States as an independent nation. As all this happened, the war, of course, continued to rage. Next week, the British, under General Howe, attack Washington's army at White Marsh, Pennsylvania.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, thanks for joining the American Revolution Podcast After Show. My continued thanks to Trey Nance and George Davis for their ongoing support of the podcast at the Alexander Hamilton Club level on Patreon. Also, welcome to Stephen Cook, Andrew Botond, and Ian Ryan, who have joined with their support at the Standard Bearer level. Everyone who supports the show on Patreon at the $10 or more per month level receives a free magnet each month with a different flag from the American Revolution, plus getting the satisfaction of helping to support this podcast. Also, my thanks to Bob Katrinos for your kind words and generous one-time contribution via PayPal. I very much appreciate anyone who can help support this podcast. This week, we return to the Continental Congress, which had to flee from Philadelphia after the British took the city. Running the country from York, Pennsylvania, really had an impact on the members. We see a great many delegates around this time actually going home and ending their service in the Continental Congress. I've often wondered how much the decision to go home had to do with the limited accommodations that were available in the city, how much may have been frustration over the progress of the war, and how much of it was simply that these guys had been at this for well over 2 years and really just wanted to get back home again. Congress did remain firmly in support of the war effort, even before receiving the good news about Saratoga. But losing the capital and fleeing westward did have an impact. Also, the continued lack of money and supplies for the army was an ongoing source of frustration for many delegates. That's probably why the Patriots treated defeatists like Jacob Doucet so harshly. They were all trying to fight off their own worries about the loss of the cause. Despite these fears, or perhaps to combat them, Congress did finally agree on a proposed Articles of Confederation. That was really a big step for Congress. They'd been debating these ever since, well, before they declared independence, and still had reached no consensus. Even after agreeing to the proposals, they would have to wait many more years before the states would actually ratify them. Still, even having something that the delegates all found acceptable was a big step forward. There are very few books that cover the Continental Congress well, and I've already recommended a couple of them. Most of them focus on a limited period of time, such as the time period leading up to the Declaration of Independence is a rather popular one. I've already recommended a few others that go a little deeper and cover other time periods when the Continental Congress was in session, and today's book recommendation follows in that line. It's a book simply called The Continental Congress by Edmund Cody Burnett. This is a fairly comprehensive book. It begins before the First Continental Congress in 1774 and ends with Congress passing over authority to the U.S. Congress under the Constitution in 1789. The book is well over 700 pages long, so it has time to dig into some considerable details. One frustration I had with the book, though, is, and one reason it's probably not terribly useful for researchers, is that there are no footnotes or endnotes anywhere to be found. I guess you just have to take the author's word for it. So while the book is very well researched and has lots of information, it's not going to be much help if you're trying to verify anything that's been written in it. The other frustrating thing about this book is that it is impossible to find. It was first published in 1941, I believe, with a reprint done in the 1960s. There are a handful of used copies available on Amazon, but even those are at crazy high prices for what it is. Fortunately, I've been able to use an e-copy that is available on archive.org, and of course you're able to view it there as well. Since the book may still be under copyright, although I doubt it is, but archive.org has to assume it may be, you can only borrow the book for a period of time. You can't permanently download it. Even so, having the book available in that limited capacity has been very helpful to me and may be useful to you as well. The author, Edmund Cody Burnett, worked for many years for the Carnegie Institute of Washington, editing correspondence of the Continental Congress. Before he produced this book, he produced a multi-volume work containing all that correspondence. I guess he felt he didn't need the footnotes to other authorities, since he pretty much was the ultimate authority on the Continental Congress at the time he was writing. Burnett was born during the Civil War and died back in 1949. But his lifetime of research into the Continental Congress and his book by that name are still an interesting read. My online recommendation this week is the transcript of the Articles of Confederation. For those of you who are interested in the Constitution, the articles provide a better understanding of where the constitutional delegates were coming from. You'll find many similar phrases that later found their way into the Constitution, and you can see where the Constitution differs from the articles because of things that ended up not working. Because the Articles of Confederation aren't good law anymore, they generally get ignored, but they very much were an important founding document, and I think one worth understanding a little better. As always, I've included a link to the transcript on my website and blog at amrevpodcast.com. Well, that's all for this week. I hope you will join me again next week for another American Revolution podcast.
What does Sputnik have to do with student loans? How did a set of trembling hands end the Soviet Union? How did inflation kill moon bases? And how did a former president decide to run for a second non-consecutive term? These are among the topics we deal with on the My History Can Beat Up Your Politics podcast. We tell stories of history that relate to today's news events. Give a listen. My History Can Beat Up Your Politics, wherever you get podcasts.